Internet regulation. Public interest groups want more. Internet companies want less. In between them is the Federal Communications Commission and its ambitious National Broadband Plan, intended to provide internet access to all Americans. Last month, the plan was nearly derailed in court. Today, the FCC announced a way around the legal obstacles, and Joel Rose reports.
The statement announcing the FCC's new approach to regulating internet access is full of words like moderate, cautious, and disciplined.
It is a narrow and tailored approach that will ensure we can protect and empower consumers, promote strong investment and innovation.
FCC Chairman Julius Genachowski talked about the approach in a video blog posted on YouTube. While FCC officials wouldn't grant an interview for this story, it's clear that they're trying to walk a very fine line. On one side are public interest groups and companies like Google and eBay that want stronger regulation to ensure open access to the internet for everybody. They were fairly happy with today's announcement. Josh Silver is the founder of the nonprofit group Free Press.
This move will give the FCC authority to enforce net neutrality, which means all information on the web will be treated equally. And it will allow them to do many other aspects of the National Broadband Plan.
That plan is supposed to make internet access faster and cheaper for all Americans. On the other side of the debate are the cable and phone companies that actually deliver broadband to most Americans. They want less regulation, and those companies are not pleased with the FCC's announcement.
What has just set up today is basically a long, hot summer in D.C. with a lot of rhetoric.
Rebecca Arbogast is an analyst at the investment firm Stifel Nicolaus in Washington. She says the new rules could hurt profits at the big internet companies.
It is not, I think, as some have suggested, the end of the world and the sky is falling. That said, it is clearly a negative for Verizon, AT&T, Comcast, the cable providers.
The FCC used to regulate internet access the same way it regulates phone companies, a lot. In 2002, the FCC itself deregulated internet access, but that proved to be a problem 2 years ago when the commission tried to punish Comcast for blocking some traffic on its network. The cable company sued, and the FCC lost, which is why today the FCC announced it wants to re-regulate internet access. Mike Wendy at the Free Market Progress and Freedom Foundation says that's the wrong approach.
To the extent that it looks like 75-year-old rules that were developed around plain old telephone service, that will probably frustrate some investment.
But the FCC insists its regulations won't hurt investment. Commission officials say they won't try to force internet providers to open their lines to competitors, as phone companies must. And that frustrates public interest advocates like Josh Silver at Free Press.
This is a reflection of the same weaknesses that were in the National Broadband Plan, a good plan, great aspirations, but conspicuously missing the tough provisions that would promote competition and drive down prices.
So far, the FCC's compromise approach is drawing criticism from both sides, but the real test is how it will play in Congress and inevitably in court. For NPR News, I'm Joel Rose.
You're listening to NPR.
And now it's time for Back Talk, where we lift the curtain on what's happening in the Tell Me More blogosphere and get to hear from you, our listeners. Lee Hill, our digital media guy, is here with us as usual. Hi, Lee.
Hey, Michelle. This week, our listeners also had more to say about that tough new immigration law in Arizona. We've been hearing from lots of folks who say it could easily lead to racial profiling. And separately, Michelle, in your commentary Monday, you raised another perspective. It was based on research showing that ethnic minorities, which includes many immigrants, come to the U.S. with racial biases themselves. You pointed out that ethnic baggage is no excuse for discrimination by anyone.
There's another matter that gets less attention and deserves more, which is whether immigrants will be called upon to surrender their own prejudices regarding race, skin color, sexual orientation, and religious preference.
As always, lots of people took to our website to weigh in with their thoughts. Blogger Tegan says racial prejudices held by non-natives slices both ways. Americans are guilty too. She writes, quote, "The more racially influenced laws are out there, the more these immigrants are not going to feel inclined to assimilate immediately and trust their host culture."
Thank you, Tegan. Lee, we've also been following the devastating aftermath of the floods in the Nashville area. Some 18 deaths are known so far to have been caused by the flood. Thousands, of course, are displaced. Yesterday on our blog, you reported on how much of the region remains submerged in water after being dumped with over 13 inches of rain. That's the most since 1979. We asked our audience in Nashville to tell us how they're faring in all this. We heard from Tyler, who had this to say.
It's hard. You grow up in a place that you've called home all your life, and then you watch the floodwaters rise into it, and it's heartbreaking. People are in their boats helping to pull out any victims. The community aspect of Nashville has always been there, but you can definitely see it now that we're in one of our hardest times.
Thanks, Tyler, and know that you all are in our thoughts and prayers.
Absolutely. Very much thinking about you in these difficult times, and we hope we'll have more on this story next week. Lee, anything else?
Just one thing we need to clarify. When talking about those heated Senate hearings with Goldman Sachs for alleged fraud in last week's barbershop, NPR political editor Ken Rutten made an incorrect reference. He said, Anthem Blue Shield in California decided to raise its premiums 39% during the height of last year's healthcare debate. Actually, Blue Shield is a separate entity and is a not-for-profit health plan. Blue Shield is not affiliated with WellPoint, the parent company of Anthem Blue Cross of California.
Thank you, Lee.
Thanks, Michelle.
And remember, with Tell Me More, the conversation never ends. To tell us more, you can call our comment line at 202-842-3522. Please remember to leave your name. You can also log on to our website. Just go to npr.org, click on Programs, then on Tell Me More, and blog it out.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. There has been yet another setback with efforts to stop the hundreds of thousands of gallons of oil that have been leaking into the Gulf waters off the Louisiana coast. BP hoped that a 100-ton steel and concrete box lowered into the water would cover the broken well and stop the leak, but ice-like crystals clogged the top of the dome. NPR's Kathy Lohr has the story.
BP's first efforts to get the containment box in place ran into major problems. Chief Operating Officer Doug Suttles says crews carefully lowered the box over the broken well, but he says a slushy mixture of gas and water called hydrates made the box too buoyant.
So what we had to do was pick the dome back up, set it over to the side while we evaluate what options we have to actually try to prevent the hydrate formation or find some other method to try to capture the flow.
The cold water 5,000 feet below the surface is partly to blame. Officials have been cautious about expectations for capping the well, and they stress they're trying completely new technology. Now BP says it may take until tomorrow to figure out the next move. Coast Guard Rear Admiral Mary Landry.
This dome is no silver bullet to stop the leak, and we continue to work on all fronts with more than 10,000 personnel now.
More than 3 million gallons of oil have spilled into the Gulf since the Deepwater Horizon rig exploded April 20th. The company continues to drill a relief well, but that could take months. Landry says dozens of crews continue to respond, skimming the water, applying dispersants, and searching for oil that might reach the shore. But it appears that is already happening. Off the marshy Louisiana coast, an oily sheen has washed into the Chandelier Islands. And more than 100 miles away, at Dauphin Island, Alabama, shoreline assessment teams examined blobs of sticky tar, some as large as golf balls, that washed ashore on a public beach Saturday. People living all along the Gulf are worried the spill will contaminate more beaches and destroy coastal wetlands. Kathy Lohr, NPR News, Plaquemines Parish, Louisiana.
Admiral Thad Allen is coordinating the federal government's response to the oil spill in the Gulf. He's the National Incident Commander and the Commandant for the United States Coast Guard. He's on the phone. Admiral Allen, welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Since they're having trouble with this oil containment box, are there any other ideas to try and stop the spread of oil?
Actually, there are a number. and people are working around the clock at the BP headquarters in Houston. One of the things they're considering is actually using a lot of pressure to put just small pieces of debris on all into the blowout preventer to just clog it up and stop the leakage that way. They're actually creating the mechanisms to do that, and we'll be sinking the probably later on this week. There's also the option to actually sever the pipe and put another blowout preventer on top of it, but that is dependent on the amount of pressure that's already in there, and they want to know as much about that as they can, and they're taking pressure readings around it. So a number of initiatives are underway.
Do you have enough booms to cover the shoreline?
Well, there's not enough boom to cover all the shoreline of the United States. We've got enough boom to cover the impacted areas right now. One of the challenging things about this the spill is it could go in a number of directions, and everybody wants to be ready. So rather than having enough boom to deal with a normal spill and where it might come ashore, this thing is omnidirectional, and everybody trying to be ready to put a huge demand on the boom manufacturing in the country. But we've gone to a central warehousing operation down there, and we're dealing with the manufacturers.
Under federal law, the oil company BP is only liable for $75 million in damages. Do you support the efforts by some members of Congress to raise that liability limit?
Well, yeah, and they're responsible for all costs. And then there's an additional cap on other expenses associated with that. I believe it's something maybe should be looked at when we're done here, but BP understands they're responsible for all costs.
Yeah, can you at all estimate how much the containment and cleanup efforts have cost so far?
Well, we're up to about the cap the Coast Guard has out of our fund is somewhere between $15 and $20 million, and I don't have the exact total of what BP is spending, but it is considerable.
What's your best estimate about how long you think this containment process is going to take?
Well, the ultimate solution is to drill a relief well, relieve the pressure that's currently in that pipe, and then cap the well. That won't be done for at least 90 days, and there is already a drilling unit on scene that's actually started to drill below the subsurface. That is the final solution. In the meantime, what we're trying to do is stop the leaks and stabilize the situation until the relief well can be dug.
What kind of environmental damage do you anticipate over that period of time?
Well, the most sensitive areas are marsh areas where you have wildlife, and especially where shellfish are spawning and that sort of thing. And, of course, it's very close to the extensive wetlands and marshes around Louisiana, Mississippi. As you move over towards Alabama, you start to have, and Mississippi, you have beaches. And into Florida, a lot of economic impact associated with the beaches where the oil to get there right now. The oil to date, though, it's only impacted the marshland areas around Louisiana. We've had some reports of tar balls in Alabama. We're not sure it's associated with this spill, but we're investigating. Right now, it appears that the impact is localized in southeast Louisiana, with the next area likely to be impacted would be Mississippi and Alabama.
You had a major job during Hurricane Katrina, and many people in the Gulf Coast region, particularly in Louisiana, were very disillusioned with the federal government's response to the hurricane. Will this time be different?
You know, I've been asked several times to compare Hurricane Katrina and this, and it's really difficult to do that because they're two very, very different events. As anomalous and as complex as Katrina was, there was a beginning and an end to it. In this oil spill, we're actually dealing with a source that does not have human access, and that's very, very different than anything we've ever done before. It's 5,000 feet down on the floor of the ocean. Everything we know through what's seen by remotely operated vehicles and remote sensing. And everything we do down there is through robotics. And this is something that we've never dealt with in a large spill before.
Do you think the government responded quickly enough after the oil rig exploded on April 20th?
I do, because I was involved in it from the start. You know, this started out as a massive search and rescue case. We had the explosion, and unfortunately there were 11 people that we were never able to find. We had a significant search and rescue effort. From the start, we had salvage teams available. We're starting to look at worst-case discharges, because when you have a rig that large, and that much fire going on, you know there's going to be something associated with it. We didn't wait to start doing the planning and pre-stage the resources. The real game changer, of course, was on the 22nd of April when the rig actually sunk. And that created the fire went out, which was consuming the product. And then we had three leaks in the riser pipe, which was 5,000 feet of pipe that was crumpled over an area about 1,500 feet between the wellhead and where the drill unit was resting upside down.
Admiral Thad Allen is the National Incident Commander for the BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. He's also the Commandant for the United States Coast Guard. Good luck. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Leanne.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. 50 years ago today, the Food and Drug Administration approved a medicine for sale that was meant to be taken by people who were not sick. and it has been called the most important scientific advance of the 20th century. The birth control pill, known today as the pill, changed social behavior, transformed the lives of women, and revolutionized family planning. Nancy Gibbs is the executive editor at Time magazine. Her article titled The Pill at 50, Sex, Freedom, and Paradox appears in this past week's issue. She joins us from Time magazine studio in New York City. Welcome to the program.
Nice to be here.
Before we talk about the pill, tell us a little bit about Margaret Sanger, who at the beginning of the 20th century ended up becoming the driving force behind the birth control movement.
She is a fascinating character. She was the daughter of Catholic parents, and she thought that the fact that her mother had 18 pregnancies during her lifetime, 11 children, contributed to her death at the age of 50. And she really made it her mission in life to find a way to give women more control over their fertility. As early as 1912, she was talking about the need for some magic pill that would improve contraception, make it more reliable and available. And remember, this is at a time when it was illegal to even distribute information about birth control. She was, you know, arrested when she would try to open the first birth control clinics in this country. So she was a crusader throughout the 20th century, and it really was her work as much as anything that drove the development of the pill.
How popular was it when it was introduced in 1960?
On the one hand, it was very rapidly adopted by women. There really was an enormous demand for a form of contraception that was so much more convenient, more reliable, less intrusive. And yet, at the same time, in those early years, contraception was still illegal in many states. And one of the great, I think, and most interesting myths that has surrounded the birth control pill is that somehow it's approved in 1960, and the next thing you know, the sexual revolution is upon us. You have Sex and the Single Girl, you have the Summer of Love, you have these enormous changes in sexual behavior in the 1960s. And what that sort of ignores is that throughout that decade, you pretty much had to be married to get a prescription for the birth control pill. Even Planned Parenthood clinics would not prescribe it to single women.
So how did the pill change the lives of women?
Well, this is where it gets very interesting. Women were much more likely to sort of invest in themselves, to invest in their education, to invest in college or in graduate school, if they did not have to worry that an unintended pregnancy might derail all of these plans. Mm-hmm. It became much harder for employers to discriminate against women on the grounds that, well, she might just get pregnant and drop out of the workforce, so why should we invest in training her? The availability of a much more reliable and effective and convenient form of contraception did create very dramatic social changes. When the pill was introduced, the average American woman had 3.6 children in 1960. By 1980, that had fallen below 2.
What about the health concerns, though? Because there still seem to be some, even though the pill that is around today is a lower dose than it was when it was first introduced.
You know, I don't think there is any other medicine that has been the subject of as many lawsuits and the subject of as much clinical testing as the birth control pill. An enormous study of the pill, 46,000 women over 40 years, was released showing, again, that it was not implicated in causing premature deaths from cancer or heart disease. But there is still real question in women's minds, and every survey reveals this about its safety for long-term use, and it's almost as though no amount of research is going to allay those concerns.
There was a study done, actually, by the National Campaign to Prevent Teen and Unplanned Pregnancy, and 63% of the young women were saying they knew little or nothing about birth control pills. And there was also a perception that minorities thought that the pill was a way to control the population of African Americans and Hispanics.
That was true at the time of its introduction, and it remains true in interesting and significant numbers today, a concern that there's a genocidal agenda behind the promotion of the birth control pill in minority communities, and that this was somehow designed to prevent reproduction among minorities. And this is something that pollsters find continues to be a perception and a concern among African Americans, among Hispanics.
Do you think the pill will still be around in 50 years?
It would be nice to think that progress in science and research continues to find, you know, an even safer, even more reliable, even more convenient, even less expensive form of contraception. There's, you know, always been rumors about the arrival one day of a male birth control pill or a shot. But I suspect that this is one, because of the cost of the research and the number of human clinical trials that are required to approve a new form of contraception, that it is going to be a long time coming.
Nancy Gibbs is executive editor at Time magazine, and her article, The Pill at 50, Sex, Freedom, and Paradox, appears in this past week's issue of Time magazine. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Leanne.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Lynn Neary. Today in Your Health, we have a pair of stories that look at teenagers and risk-taking. It's a necessary part of growing up and becoming independent, but teens and risks can be a dangerous combination. Teen drivers, who are the least experienced on the road, are also big texters. We begin with NPR's Patty Naimond, who talked to teens and asked experts what can be done to discourage distracted driving.
Minnesota teenager Natalie Hayford says it's completely understandable why so many kids text even when they're driving.
It's just so hard not to. You text message while you're doing anything else. People text message in school, when you're walking, you do it, everything, and it's just habit where they may not even think about text messaging while they're driving, they just do it.
Amanda Lenhart has heard the same thing. She's with the Pew Research Center's Internet and American Life Project. She surveyed 800 teens and their parents in four cities about texting and driving. During her focus groups with teens, Lenhart was amazed to discover kids were secretly texting under the table while talking to researchers.
We asked them in our focus groups whether or not they ever turned their phones off, and the majority of teens there gave us looks of horror, as though they couldn't conceive of the idea of turning it off. They might put it on silent or vibrate, but they would never actually want to cut themselves off from that network of communication that the phone represented.
Lenhart found, on average, teens text about 50 times a day, but some send more than 200, and one in four admitted texting while driving. 16-year-old Bethany Brown of Cave Creek, Arizona, wants to stop distracted driving. We caught up with her as she won a prize for a video she made warning kids about distracted driving. She thinks teens are aware of the danger.
But they think, oh, well, I have just one message. I can just do the quick text here. I'm at a stoplight. It's not going to turn green anytime soon. They know the statistics and they know what can happen, but they don't think it'll happen to them.
Bethany Brown's winning video shows a crash that follows after a teenage driver picks up a phone. The video then rewinds back to the beginning, showing the same kid ignoring the ringing phone and driving safely down the street. Federal research shows nearly 6,000 people were killed in 2008 in car crashes involving a distracted driver, though it's not clear how many of those distractions were due to cell phones or texting. Research on that isn't available yet. In any case, Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood says laws are the way to stop people from texting and phoning while driving. So far, about half the states have cell phone bans. And LaHood says two federally funded pilot projects, one in Connecticut and one in New York, have stepped up police enforcement.
Enforcement worked with seatbelt laws, and now 85% of the people use seatbelts. And people said you couldn't get drunk drivers off the road, but with strong enforcement, it's been done. Strong enforcement will get cell phones and Blackberries out of people's hands while they're driving.
Technology might help, too. For example, software has been designed that would literally shut a phone down if it's used in a moving vehicle. But the biggest influence on teens right now may be parents. Minnesota teen Natalie Hayford agrees. She's active with a student group against distracted driving.
If parents aren't text messaging while driving, and they never have and they don't speed or whatever, it's more likely the teen won't participate in those activities. So if the parent is always on their cell phone, the teen's like, oh, it's fine, my parents do it all the time. And if their parents haven't crashed, then it's kind of like, okay, it's not going to happen.
Research hasn't been done to pin down the role of parents in distracted driving, but studies have shown that teens follow their parents' lead when it comes to reckless driving. Teens are more likely to get tickets or be involved in car crashes if their parents have. And Amanda Lenhart's focus groups provide some evidence that kids are watching their parents, and not only as positive role models. Lenhart says some kids are actually scared when driving with their parents.
They would tell stories about their parents texting with the phone while trying to drive with their knees. They would talk about other ways in which parents were sometimes distracted behind the wheel, including using GPS or trying to use a walkie-talkie function on a phone or make calls.
Well, I used to use it a lot.
until Bethany entered that contest.
Don Brown is the father of teenage video producer Bethany. Encouraged by his daughter, he's put his cell phone away while driving.
I really haven't noticed that big of a difference in productivity. I mean, I don't think I've missed anything by not really answering the phone that I couldn't pick up later.
It wasn't easy, says Brown, but he's gotten used to it. And now, like his daughter, he encourages others to do the same. Bethany Brown's video starts airing on television nationwide this month. Patty Namond, NPR News.